karma is that we believe so strongly in the appearances of this life. So we only experience this life. We think, therefore we think that's all that exists. We create identities around this life. I am this gender, I am this socioeconomic class, I am this kind of personality. And we believe that this is true, that that's who we are. We believe in the appearance that our happiness and our suffering come from outside. And so therefore we engage in a continuous struggle with the things and people around us to be close to what we think gives us happiness and distance ourselves from the things that we believe don't. And so in that way we just get stuck in our ordinary lives and our ordinary ways of looking at things and wind up miserable, because at the end of the day all these things that we work so hard to procure and to line up all disappear. And at the time of death it's only our consciousness with its karmic imprints and its habitual mental states that continues on. And so the more that we realize that our mind is totally out of whack with what reality is, that we don't have much of a clue at all about how things exist and what the causes of suffering and happiness are, the more we realize the deficiency in our usual view, then the more energy we have for seeking an alternative, for seeking a refuge that is fully competent, wise, compassionate, and in tune with reality. And so for that reason we go to refuge, to the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And we develop the motivation to become the three jewels ourselves, to become the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, so that we can be of the greatest aid to all other sentient beings who are stuck like we presently are in confusion. So generate this bodhicitta mind based on very strong refuge. So this view that all that exists is what we perceive with our senses, that our normal world is all that there is, this is precisely the ignorant view that keeps us so entrenched and trapped. As we've created an identity, you know, this is who I think I am, this is what I want or need to be happy. So I gotta get it. This is what interferes with my happiness, so I have to destroy it. And this all appears to us as so real and such a logical way of viewing things. Attachment seems very reasonable from this point of view, doesn't it? Something makes me happy, therefore I should cling to it. Yeah, something makes me miserable, therefore I should hate it. It seems very reasonable and logical within that framework, doesn't it? And so that's what we believe, and that's how we live our life. Yeah, I deserve to grasp on and hold on to everything I want. I should be able to get it. It doesn't matter what the rest of the world wants. I'm me, and after all, I'm the center of the universe, so I should get what I want. Right? Yeah. Other people interfere with my getting what I want. They interfere with my happiness. You know, that means they're destroying the center of the universe, which is really definitely catastrophic. So we have every right to destroy them in return. You know? We drop our verbal bombs on our personal friends, and we drop real bombs on political enemies, you know? So, life goes on like this, and we think we're creating the causes of happiness and abandoning the causes of suffering. And, in fact, we're just getting more of the above. Again and again and again and again. True or not true? Yeah? We've all lived long enough to know that we're just keeping... What was that? Somebody told me a good quote recently. I think it was Albert Einstein. Said, what was it? That real stupidity is when you do the same thing twice but expect a different result. You know? And that's exactly what we do in our life. You know, we get into the same kind of dysfunctional relationships again and again because we think that sometime it's going to be different this time. We do the same kind of, you know, confusion about our financial matters again and again and again, thinking that sometime this time it's going to be different. We replay our same excuses about why we have no time or money to practice the Dharma, as if the Buddha charged time and money, you know, and so we, you know, validate our inability to do any practice. You know, we just keep doing the same thing and expect that it's going to bring a different result this time, you know. So that's pretty stupid. So, I mean, we have to realize we're stupid if we don't, you know. We have the Buddha nature. So in one part of us, we have this tremendous potential. In the other part of us, we're totally foolish. Yeah. And I think part of our foolishness and stupidity is we don't realize we have the Buddha potential. So we think the best we can do in life is, you know, kind of make a few more $1,000s a year. You know, that's the best I can do in my life. Yeah, or move into a nicer house, or get a better computer, or get a better, you know, entertainment system. We think that's our whole human potential. That's stupid, isn't it? It is totally stupid. So, you know, on one hand we have to realize how stupid we are, and on the other hand we have to realize how much incredible potential we have. Yeah? And then really try and tap into that potential and do something useful with it instead of just, you know, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Yeah? Okay, so like I was saying in the motivation, you know, just whatever appears, we believe in so readily, and we believe it's really true, and we don't question it at all. Yeah? I mean, we question the wrong thing. We doubt our capacity to become a Buddha. We doubt our capacity for anybody to, we doubt anybody's capacity to be unselfish. Yeah, we doubt that it's possible to be free of anger and still be safe. Yeah, we doubt all the things that are true. Yeah, what isn't true is what we believe wholeheartedly. Yeah, that if I only convince this person to love me, then I'm going to be happy forever after. That's what we think. You know, I only remodel my house this is such a way, then I'm going to be done with it. Yeah. If I only buy a new boat, then I'm going to, you know, be able to sail away to freedom. Okay. So, you know, that whatever appears in this life, whatever society teaches us, we don't question at all. You know, I mean, the Buddha who has full wisdom and compassion, we doubt like mad. Society, which we look at and is totally confused. I mean, if what's going on in this world is not mass confusion, tell me what is. Yeah, the 6 o'clock news is not indicative of mass confusion. Okay? But what the world believes, we salute and we say, yes, I follow that. But the Buddha we doubt up, down, and across. So I think one thing that's really important for us is to get in touch with what our own experience is and to be able to look realistically at our own experience. And when we do that, then we'll be able to gain some wisdom because we'll be able to refute the view of the world and validate the teachings of the Buddha. And this all comes through being able to look at our own experience. It doesn't come through blind belief. Okay? It isn't like Buddha teaches something and we're all good kids and go to Buddhist catechism class and, you know, come out as good Buddhists saying, I promise to believe, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's not going to do anything for us. Yeah? What the Buddha's really asking us to do is look very closely with wisdom at what our experience is. You know? And compare the Buddha's teachings to our experience. You know, analyze the Buddha's teachings. See if they describe our experience. If they do, then our confidence in the teachings and the Dharma becomes very solid because we see its truth through our own lives. Yeah, so it's just some kind of intellectual blah blah. But it's not that we're saying we believe something because we have to fulfill somebody else's expectations or avoid being excommunicated or something like that. Okay. So really practicing involves challenging a lot of our very deeply ingrained beliefs. Beliefs that are so deeply ingrained that we don't even realize that they're beliefs. That's the thing. You know, they are so much a part of our outlook that we don't even realize that they're beliefs. We just think that they're reality. Yeah? Like somebody hurts me, therefore my anger is justified. We never question that. Is that logical? Somebody hurts me, therefore anger is justified? Therefore anger is going to bring me happiness? Or another one of our logic things is, you know, I feel happy when I'm with somebody, therefore I should cling on to them. That seems logical, but if you examine it, it's not very logical. So we have to really start questioning a lot of these things. Yeah, it involves really a lot of courage to examine beliefs that are very deeply held, so much so that we don't see them as beliefs. Okay? And when we start examining them, of course the self-centered, ignorant mind is going to fight back. Yeah. Self-centered, ignorant mind is not stupid. It's not going to weigh over and say, sure, I'm going to go along with this Dharma jazz. It's going to fight back like mad. Yeah? And it's going to, you know, self-centered ego mind is the author of the book 300,295,317 Ways That I Cannot Practice the Dharma. Okay. That is authored by ego mind. So, you know, when ego starts to proliferate, when we start to practice, then we get a little bit nervous. You know? And all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I want to get out of here. So therefore, I'm too busy. Yeah, I'm too busy. That is our sacred excuse in America. Yeah. Whenever somebody says, I'm too busy, you never question that, do you? Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to question that. When somebody says, I'm too busy, it is totally impolite to say, are you? Really? What are you doing? if somebody does that, it's like, wow, this person is so impolite, you know. I mean, that's more impolite than they're asking about our sex life, is to ask, what are you doing with your time? That, you know, you never do that to anybody. So that is our sacred reason that we use all the time while we can't practice the Dharma. I'm too busy. I have too much on my plate. Right? Yeah. And the next one that we use as our excuse why we can't practice is, I don't have enough money. Okay. As if to sit on your meditation cushion or read a book, you know, they charge you $75 an hour. No. Nobody charges you anything. Yeah. But we don't have enough money. Right? And again, that's inviolable. Nobody is allowed to question that. When you say, I don't have enough money, it's extremely impolite to question that and say, well, what are you spending your money on? Tell me. Huh?
We think that we, in our mind, we question that.
Yeah. But, you know, nobody is allowed to question that for us. And so ego mind has just a free rein. It just goes on and with its reasons. Yeah. And we make all these reasons, you know, they're real. So real that we even go to our spiritual teachers and, oh, I'd really like to do this practice, but I don't have enough time. Yeah, as if our spiritual mentors are going to believe that. You know, I mean, that's how stupid we are. We think that they're going to believe that. Oh, I can't do my Dharma practice. I don't have enough money. Yeah. You know, I mean, we really think our spiritual teachers are going to believe that. That's, again, how stupid we are. What we're really saying is Dharma's not my priority. You know, let's at least be honest about it. You know? And instead of making up excuses, say, I'm very sorry, but Dharma's not my priority in life. Yeah? I want happiness of this life. Yeah? And I think getting this, that, and the other thing is going to make me happy. I know you've told me it isn't going to. And I know from my experience it hasn't. But I still believe it will. And this is what I want out of life. So that, therefore, that's why I can't practice the Dharma. I mean, really, we should at least be honest about it. Okay? But we aren't, are we? We're not honest with ourselves. We're not honest with our spiritual mentors. We're not honest with the Buddha. Yeah. We just, you know, go on and on and on. Okay? So it all comes down to priorities. Yeah? And our priorities are based on what we think is going to bring us happiness. Mm-hmm. And what we think is going to bring us happiness is based on what idea we have of what happiness is. And our current idea of what happiness is very low-grade happiness. Compared to the happiness that we're capable of, what we think happiness is low-grade. Okay? So we think sense pleasure happiness is real happiness. Yeah, sitting in a room that's beautifully designed, with people that we like, it's the right temperature, where we hear only pleasant sounds, smell only pleasant smells, when we look forward to a delicious lunch, yeah, that tastes the best, that is low fat, and we won't put on weight. Yeah. Yeah, we think this is what happiness is. Yeah, and so we seek it. And I, you know, and from a Buddhist perspective, that's really low-grade happiness. Because what it is, it's a little bit of sense pleasure, but sense pleasure doesn't last very long, does it? You know, you eat, and it's gone within. How long does it one mouthful take? Yeah, how long? We should time it, you know. How long it takes to chew one mouthful. And that's how long the happiness lasts. Yeah, because we're no sooner done with one mouthful than we need another one. Then we need another one, then we need another one. Okay? So we think that all of that's going to bring us happiness. Yeah. Or we think, you know, entertainment is going to bring us happiness. Going to the movies. Yeah? So we have our addiction to the cinema, our addiction to TV, our addiction to surfing the internet. Yeah, we even surf the internet looking at all the Dharma sites because we think at least that's Dharma. But it's still, you know. Yeah, looking for the nicest, most beautiful retreat center with the daily schedule that lets you sleep late. Okay? So, you know, we think that that's what happiness is. And yet, from the Buddhist perspective, when we look at, you know, our human potential, that stuff is like piddlydink, you know. It's like not worth anything. I mean, just consider, how happy do you think you'd be if you had the confidence that anger would never arise in your mind again? Okay? If you had that total confidence that no matter how somebody treated you, no matter what they said about you, no matter how much they put you down or rejected you, or anything like that, that you had the confidence that your mind would be completely calm without anger or resentment or hurt. Do you think that would bring you happiness, having that kind of confidence? Is that kind of happiness more a greater level of happiness than the happiness from eating and, you know, having a good conversation with somebody? It's a greater kind of happiness, isn't it? Yeah. It's the kind of happiness that really brings lasting peace in our heart, having the confidence that I will never, ever get bummed out again. So we have that potential. We can become like that. Yeah, it's not fairy tales. It's actually possible. There have been human beings who have done that before. And we all have the same human potential. So it's just a question of if we cultivate it or not. Yeah. If we think of that kind of happiness and see that as something really worthwhile, that we want to go to it. Yeah. If we do, then we're going to look for those who can guide us towards that kind of happiness. And that's where refuge comes in. Okay? Because we're turning to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as those who will guide us towards that kind of happiness. Yeah. Or think for a minute, what would it be like to be perfectly content within yourself so that you never felt like you were missing something on the outside. In other words, you felt completely whole. You didn't need anybody else to love you. You don't need anybody else to approve of you. You don't need a good job and a lot of money to feel that you're a worthwhile person. That you feel like a whole person inside and you're completely content. Can you imagine that? What would that feel like? Is that a better kind of happiness than what we usually spend our time looking for? where we have the confidence that no matter where I am and who I'm with, my mind's content. Where we have the confidence that even when I'm dying, I'm completely okay. Imagine that, you know, having the confidence that when you die, that dying is like going on a picnic. You know, no fear, no worry, no, I'm leaving everything I'm familiar with and love. But instead, the mind's just completely content. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of happiness that we have the capacity to experience if we create the causes for it. Okay? Or imagine, for a moment, the kind of happiness you would experience in your heart if every time you saw any sentient being, your first reaction was one of love and compassion and understanding. Okay? So, not just seeing your friends and your relatives who care about you, you know, but even you see the garbage collector, or the tax collector, or the cops, or the people at the grocery store, or the gas station, your first experience is one of love and compassion, of feeling connected to that other sentient being. Yeah. Where wherever you saw, you know, a photo of George Bush or a photo of Saddam Hussein, your reaction was one of love and compassion and understanding, not fear and suspicion and anger. Whenever you saw a snake or a rat or a scorpion or a tiger, yeah, or some mean person who's harmed you, where your first reaction is one of love and compassion. Yeah. Can you imagine the kind of happiness you would feel inside? Just think for a minute. If that was automatically your result, in other words, you weren't sitting there having to, you know, bend your mind every which way to figure out how to, you know, see something good about somebody. But automatically, your mind felt some love and compassion. Yeah? Wouldn't that be an incredible state of mind to have?
What was interesting in my mind, and it came back and said, well, then how am I going to know what's good and bad? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even asking it, we just volunteered that.
Yeah. So, yes, that this is what ego mind does. How am I going to know what is good or bad? Because right now, what is good is what I'm attached to, and what is bad is what I hate. That's how we define good and bad, isn't it? We think good and bad are external criteria that involve reasoning, but in fact, it's completely based on our own subjective experience. Somebody does something to me that I don't like, they're bad. Even if they do gazillions of things to other people that are wonderful. If they do one bad thing to me, one thing that I don't like, then they're bad. Mm-hmm. Then they're morally inferior. Somebody out of kindness points out our faults to us, we hate him. Yeah? Somebody who's trying to manipulate us and get something out of us, praises us, we love him. Okay? So we think that the person who's trying to help us is an enemy and we're angry at them, and we think that the person who's flattering and manipulating us is a friend and we love them. And that's how we define good and bad, completely in terms of our own, you know, ego experience of things. And we believe that that's truth. Pretty sad, isn't it? Yeah. And so that's why we have this fear of, you know, well, I'm not going to know what's good and bad if I just love everybody. Yeah. But what's wrong with loving the person and thinking that a certain action is unsuitable or harmful? Okay? No matter who does the action, it's unsuitable or harmful. You know, of course, depending on the situation, the motivation, and other things. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to discriminate what's beneficial and not beneficial, besides what I like and what I don't like. Okay. Like, somebody wrote me an email recently, you know, kind of talking about how the cup is perfect no matter what is in it, or, you know, the world is perfect no matter what is going on. And I get really lost when people talk like that. I don't get it. I mean, I know sometimes it comes up in different Buddhist traditions. You know, everything's already perfect. We don't need to make it that way. And things come up in New Age, especially, they use this thing. You know, it's perfect already. But what does perfect mean? Yeah. What perfect means to me is it's the way I want it to be. Yeah. Perfect is that I get everything I want. Doesn't matter the rest of the world. Doesn't matter ethical conduct. It's perfect if I get what I want. Yeah. Actually, a Buddhist sense of perfection, you know. I don't think there's... The way we define perfect, I don't really know how we define perfect, but somehow, you know, even though the word comes up in Buddhism, it's somehow different than we think of it. Yeah? The world is perfect as it is, with everybody killing each other. No, I don't think so. You know, do we need to make it perfect in order to let go of our hatred? Yeah. Do we need to say that somebody's wonderful in order to not hate them? Or can we still see them as a sentient being who's confused and does harmful actions and still not hate them? Get what I mean? Yeah? Okay. So in other words, our criteria for what we like and what we don't like is really confused. It's based basically on personal preference. And it's based on confusing the action with the person. Yeah, people do all kinds of actions, don't they? I mean, even the people that we love the most do all kinds of ridiculous things. But we don't see their ridiculous things as ridiculous because we love them. Unless they do too many ridiculous things, that then we start seeing them as horrible people and we stop seeing their nice things as good. Okay. So we're really quite confused in our judgments and evaluations of people. Yeah. And I think it's much more productive to see that, you know, all sentient beings have the Buddha nature and they all have defilements on their minds. Okay, but what is good and bad ethically, yeah, doesn't depend on whether we like or don't like somebody. Okay, yeah, and I think we should throw out the vocabulary of a person being a good person or a bad person, because if you have the Buddha nature, how can you say it's good or, a person's good or bad? You can say an action is good or bad. You can say a mental affliction is harmful. But can you say a person is good or bad? Okay. So when we think of the kind of happiness that we have the potential to experience, yeah, and we see that the happiness that we think is happiness actually is quite low grade and not very reliable at all, then we begin to say, well, okay, I need to make a shift here and change my priorities and change what I'm doing, but I need some guidance, okay? And I need the guidance of those who are wiser, of those who have accomplished what I want to go towards. And so it's for that reason that we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay? The Dharma is the real refuge because it's the cessations of all of the negativities. Okay? The Dharma is the real refuge because it's the path, it's the consciousnesses that are in tune with reality that lead us to cease all the anger and hatred and those kinds of things. So the Dharma is the real refuge. When we actualize the Dharma, when our mind becomes the Dharma, then there's no fear anymore because, you know, our mind's totally transformed. The Sangha are the ones who are practicing the Dharma, and the Sangha that we take refuge in is the Arya Sangha, those individuals, whether lay or ordained, who have realized the emptiness of inherent existence non-conceptually. So they're the real Sangha that we take refuge in, and because they've realized reality, they can act as a good support system to us. Yeah. And the Buddha's the one who explained the Dharma out of his own experience. So the Buddha did not invent the Dharma. Okay, the Buddha did not create the world, and the Buddha did not create our suffering, and the Buddha cannot remove our suffering by waving a magic wand, or, you know, he can't. There's a beautiful quote saying how the Buddha cannot remove our suffering like you pull a thorn out of somebody's foot, and he can't give us his realizations like we pour our water into a glass. Okay? But what the Buddha does is he describes the path to us, teaches us how to practice it, and through following those instructions and practicing it, then we actualize the result ourselves, and our own mind transforms into the Dharma. Okay. So our happiness, yeah, does not depend on propitiating the Buddha and pleasing the Buddha so that we avoid punishment. Okay, and so we don't praise the Buddha because we need to get in the Buddha's good graces. Yeah. Whenever we say praises to the Buddha, it's because it's for our benefit. It uplifts our own mind, you know, and helps us to see the Buddha's qualities more and enhances our refuge and our confidence. But we don't praise the Buddha because the Buddha needs it. Buddha does not have ego problems. Yeah, we have ego problems, so we need people to praise us. Yeah, we want everybody to go, oh, you're so good. You're so good, you're so wonderful, you're so beautiful, you're so handsome. The one I love the most, we like lots of strokes. Okay, Buddha does not need this. Okay? So when we praise the Buddha, we're not doing the Buddha a favor. We're doing it because it's something that helps our own mind. Okay? When we make offerings to the Buddha, yeah, we're not doing it to get in the Buddha's good graces. Yeah, we make offerings to people and give them birthday presents and Christmas presents to get in their good graces, don't we? Yeah, we give people little gifts because we want them either to do something for us or, sneakier yet, we want them to like us. So that's how we earn people's liking us, is we give them gifts. Okay, I give you a gift, then your repayment is that you like me. You cannot lot like me if I give you a gift. Okay? So, but, you know, we don't need to worry about that when, you know, when we make offerings to the Buddha, because the Buddha already likes us. Okay? We don't have to make the Buddha like us by giving him presents. Yeah? And the Buddha's not going to dislike us if we don't give him presents. And again, you know, I mean, if you're Buddha, what are you going to get out of, you know, 7 bowls of water and some flowers? You know? Yeah? So we make the offerings to the Buddha because it's something that enhances us. You know, it's something that deepens our feeling of connection with the three jewels. Okay? We make offerings to the Buddha because it's a practice that frees us from miserliness, and it's a practice that helps us share beauty instead of clutching at beauty for ourselves. Okay, so we do all these things, you know, not for the sake of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but because they benefit our own spiritual practice. Okay, Buddha doesn't need these things. Yeah. We don't have a statues of the 16 arhats so that the arhats will like us. You know, we don't have a tanka of Tara so that Tara will like us. You know, in our family we put up all the people we like because, you know, then they come and they see that their pictures are in our house. So then we know that they like us and they appreciate us. You know how it is when you walk into somebody's house and you're expecting to see a picture of yourself and it's not there? Even on the refrigerator. Yeah, with the coupons on top of it. Okay. But Buddha doesn't need this, you know. We have the tankas and the statues and all these things because it helps us. Okay, we look at the Buddha and it inspires us in our practice. Okay, so when we really want to develop our human potential because we want another kind of happiness, then we turn to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for refuge. Okay. Now, when we turn to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for refuge, we have to know exactly how it is that they help us. And so what I was just saying before about they don't help us by taking the thorn out of our foot or by pouring their realizations into us like pouring water. The way they help us is by teaching us, by guiding us, by inspiring us. They can't do the work for us. So even though in many of our prayers, you know, we're saying, please inspire me to da 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 da, or please bless me to da 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 da. Bless or inspire means that they teach us and we have an open, receptive heart so that our own mind gets transformed by hearing, thinking, and meditating. Okay, that's what bless and inspire us mean. It isn't like, you know, Tara, please bless me. And then Tara takes out her magic wand and goes, boom! And we go, boom, now I'm blessed. Yeah? Okay. That's not quite it. Yeah. Actually, Tara's trying to boing us a lot because we sleep through it. Yeah. Tara's boing us. And say, you don't need to get angry about that, you know. And Tara warns us and says, you don't need to get attached about that, but we sleep right through that. Okay? But that's the way that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are trying to help us, okay, is to, by giving us teachings that we can apply to our own life. Yeah. So don't think of the Buddha as a manager of the universe who has the power to reshape the universe and make it become exactly what you want it to be, according to your ego's likes and dislikes. You know, because that's our usual way of praying, isn't it? When we think of what is prayer in whatever religion we grew up in, it's usually a thing of requesting somebody that's more powerful than us to give us what we want. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And you were taught how to pray as a kid? Yeah? It was more asking somebody who we thought was more powerful than us, who can change everything, to change it and make it the way we want it to be. Okay? But you know, when we talk about the Buddha's qualities, the Buddha is omniscient, but the Buddha is not omnipotent. And see, this is here you can see very clearly of the difficulties in believing in a creator God who's a manager of the universe. Because if there were a God who created the universe and had total power over it, a God who was omnipotent, then there's absolutely no reason for suffering to exist. Because if someone had the power, you know, and presumably had enough compassion, to eliminate all the suffering, they would have done it. If you're fully compassionate, there's no reason, and you have the power, there's no reason to keep sentient beings suffering. Yeah. So if there's a creator of the universe who's a manager of it, and things are not suffering free, then either that means that the creator lacks compassion, or the creator lacks power, or the creator lacks wisdom. Because if you have power and wisdom and compassion all together, what need is there to keep your creations in suffering? Think about it. You know, it doesn't make any sense at all. Totally ridiculous. So when they say, because this is the question I used to ask as a teenager, long before I heard about Buddhism. You know, if God is omnipotent, why is there suffering? Well, we're supposed to learn from the suffering. God keeps suffering there, so we learn from it. Well, why didn't God create us smarter if God is omnipotent and created us? What was it? Why did he create us stupid? He should have created us smarter. Don't you think? Yeah? So you see, the whole way of seeing a creator God who's a manager of the universe, who can wave a magic wand and make things come about, that's just kind of our childish, you know, thinking. Yeah? How we as little kids wanted mommy and daddy to be able to protect us from everything. And our big childhood disappointment was that mommy and daddy are human beings. Yeah? Not one of the most difficult things we had to learn as kids is that mommy and daddy are human beings. Yeah? We're still trying to learn it, right? Yeah? We still expect mommy and daddy, you know, to be able to do everything for us. And if they didn't do it or can't do it, something's wrong with it. Okay. Stupid. Stupid way of thinking. Mommy and daddy are human beings. Yeah? Okay? So, you know, it's this thing of believing in a creator God who's going to be able to fix it. It's just that same, you know, very childish, naive way of you know, abdicating our power and hoping somebody else will make it all better for us. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Remember when you got hurt as a kid, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, you know, you get a scratch and it's like, oh, bad table for scratching you. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, what an incredible way to teach a kid that the source of suffering comes outside of them. Look how you do it, just in subtle, innocuous ways. You know, oh, it's a bad table because you bumped into it and hurt yourself. Huh? I mean, we were indoctrinated like that for a kid. Blame the outside, the table's fault if I got scratched. Okay. And then how to do it. Kiss it and make it better. You remember that one? Yeah? Did you do that? Yeah? Did you get that too? We all got it. Come on, guys. You got it. Kiss it and make it better. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of how we, you know, expected the rest of life to go as well. Yeah. So we're going to find somebody who's going to go, well, I can make it better. Yeah. And we're still looking for the perfect person who's going to do that, aren't we? Yeah. They're going to show up sometime or another and kiss it and make it better. Yeah. So, but you know, this hasn't been our experience. Yeah. Whereas, you know, when we were kids, we were taught that God could kiss it and make it better. You know, if you praise God enough, you know, and gave him enough things and stuff like that, he could kiss it and make it better. Buddha did never made any kind of promises to that effect. Okay? Yeah. Because Buddha's not omnipotent. Buddha has the full compassion and wisdom and skillful means and power. With from his own side, in other words, a Buddha, he or she or it, has no hindrances from their own side about what they can do. But they have to work within the field of our karma. Because things are dependent arisings. Things are not independently existent. Yeah? We have to have created the cause. Okay, if we're asking for inspiration, we have to have created the cause to be inspired. Okay. It's like, you know, we want there to be rain because we want crops. But if we don't plant the seeds, we might pray for rain and get rain, but nothing's going to grow. Okay? So part of this whole thing is a process of us creating the causes. So they often give an analogy of the Buddha is like the sun. In that the sun shines everywhere indiscriminately. Okay? From the side of the sun, there's no hindrances where it can shine. Okay? It isn't like the sun has some dull spot somewhere and there's no light coming out of that dull spot, or it isn't like the sun built a brick wall in front of it and so this, you know, the sunlight can't get out. From the side of the sun, there's no hindrances to the light going out. Okay. From the side of the earth and the beings on the earth, there's hindrances to sunlight shining there. Okay, so if you have an upside down cup, it doesn't matter how clear the sky is and how bright the sun is, it's dark inside the cup. Yeah? So if you want the sunshine to go inside the cup, you have to start turning the cup right side up. And you don't turn it right side up all at once, it kind of creaks, you know? But every little bit that you start to get even one side of that cup off the ground, that much light is coming inside of it. So you see, the hindrance for the light coming in is from the side of the cup, not from the side of the sun. Yeah. So it's the same way, you know, from the side of a Buddha. A Buddha is like sitting there ready, willing, and able to teach us, you know, 25/7. Yeah. But from our side, we're not prepared. We're not, you know, open receptive vessels. We're kind of creaky. Yeah. We kind of say, oh, not now. I'm tired, Buddha. Come back later. Okay. Or not now. I'm having this love affair first. I'll practice the Dharma later. Or I'm busy writing emails to my friend, or I'm busy watching TV, or I'm busy going to the shopping center, or I'm busy eating a half gallon of ice cream, or I'm busy, you know. So Buddha, please come back later. Okay? So that's like the cup being upside down, saying, I can't turn myself right side up. I'm too busy being upside down. Yeah, I'm too busy being upside down, and anyway, being right side up is too hard. It's just too hard. I mean, son, what do you expect of me to be right side up? Yeah, somebody else should make me right side up. Son, it's your responsibility to turn me right side up. Huh? It's the son's responsibility? Yeah? So it's similar with us, you know. It's like we have to slowly begin to make ourselves more and more suitable vessels to receive the Dharma. And we're the ones who have to do that. Nobody can crawl inside of us and push a few buttons and make us, you know, lose interest in all of our substance abuses, you know, all of our various addictions. No, we have to do that kind of work ourselves. Right? But the Buddha is very compassionate and gives us the tools to be able to do that. Yeah. But we're the ones who have to do it. It's the same thing if you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You know, any of you who are parents know that you can you can lead your toddler to food, but you can't make it eat, you know. And you can go, okay, Johnny, here's the airplane. And Johnny goes, ooh, and it doesn't go in. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you cannot make your kid eat if your kid doesn't want to. Yeah. So it's the same way with us. Yeah. So we have to you know, kind of open our mouth a little bit so the nourishment can go in. Yeah. The Buddha's trying in so many ways to teach us the Dharma. You know, so many little airplanes going, here it comes. Oh, goodbye. The place coming in the bag. Yeah, I mean, the Buddha's really trying and makes it interesting and amusing and colorful, and we just keep shutting our mouths. Yeah, so we should try opening our mouths sometimes, you know, because it might actually taste good. We might actually get some nourishment. Yeah. So you see, the Buddha's omnipotent, and not omnipotent. The Buddha's omniscient, but not omnipotent. So it's a dependent arising between the wisdom, compassion, skill, and power of the enlightened ones, working ceaselessly, dragging us to enlightenment as we are kicking and screaming and holding on to our teddy bear saying, I want to stay in samsara. Okay? So, yeah, it's this dependent arising of us like letting go a little bit. Yeah? And trusting in our own capacity for goodness. Yeah? And so when we make prayers to the Buddha and we're saying, you know, please inspire me for this, or please bless me so that that happens, or please this or please that, what we're actually doing is trying to transform our own mind. Because it's by the Buddha giving us the tools to deal with our own mind that we're able to be happy through our own practice. Okay? So it's not by the Buddha changing the external circumstances. Sometimes, you know, if we've created the cause, then by making offerings and praises to the Buddha, that can result karmically in the external circumstances being changed. And so for that reason, you know, that's why we often do various pujas and prayers, you know, in the hopes that we've created some good karma, and here we are creating some more good karma to be able to change the actual external circumstances. But more often, when we're making prayers on so on, the real thing we're trying to change is our own mind, so that no matter what the external circumstance is, our mind can be happy in it. Yeah? Because that's the real freedom, isn't it? Our mind's really free when no matter what the external circumstances, we're okay. You know, we accept it, we see the beauty in it, we feel connected with the sentient beings in it. Yeah. So real happiness doesn't depend on everything being, the external world being the way our ego mind wants it to be. Real happiness depends on our mind changing and opening up and having the tools to make itself happy no matter what the external circumstances. You know, so we read stories of people who have been imprisoned, you know, in Tibet and China and who knows where, and who have endured incredible amounts of suffering, but still their minds have been peaceful. Yeah. And we read stories of people who have every luxury in the world and are miserably unhappy. Okay. So what it's showing is that really our happiness or our suffering depends on the state of our mind, not on our ability to arrange external people and things to be the way we want them to be. And to have happiness, we don't need to say everything's perfect. Okay? So in order to have happiness in this world, we don't need to say this world is perfect just as it is. It's not perfect. There's a tremendous amount of suffering in it. But we can still be content and happy ourselves and work to improve whoever the situations of those who are around us. That's completely possible. But we don't need to say everything's perfect in order to feel some kind of happiness ourselves.